You guys, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books was nominated for a Webby Award, which is this really prestigious award that I am dying to win. And there's a People's Voice component, and you can vote and get me from number two, second place, to first place. But you have to vote. Please go to vote.webbys.com. Vote.webbys.com, but it's kind of complicated, so it might be easier just to go to zibbyowens.com or my Instagram at zibbyowens, where it'll always be in my stories and it's in one of those little circle highlights. Please, please, please vote. Voting ends April 18th and I'm in second place, so please vote for best individual episode, talk show, interview show. Thank you so much.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you like this podcast, you will love my new anthology called Moms Don't Have Time to Have Kids. Check it out, and you'll hear from 49 authors about all sorts of things moms don't have time to do. All the authors have been on this podcast. Also, check out my TikTok, at With Zibby and Tracy, my other podcast, Sex Talk with Zibby and Tracy. Check out Moms Don't Have Time to Write on Medium. And of course, my new publishing company called Zibby Books. And now back to our daily author interview site and a quick hello from some of my kids.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Enjoy the show. Hilma Wolitzer is the author of Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. Hilma is the author of 9 novels, 4 books for children, and a writing guide. She has received many awards, including Guggenheim and NEA fellowships, and has led fiction workshops at several universities and at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. Her first novel was published when she was in her mid-40s. She's 91 years old and lives in New York City. Welcome, Hilma. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket stories.
Thank you so much, Zibby, for having me here.
You're so welcome. This is an amazing collection of stories spanning all of a woman's life, her relationship. Some stories all interweave, others don't. It's so amazing to watch through the years. Your first story came out in this book in, what, 1966?
Yes.
1966, all the way through the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, what a ride. And just that there were so many, like some of the ones you wrote so early on could have been written yesterday. It's amazing.
That really gratifies me. I looked back at them after I had to put them together into the collection, and I realized there were no cell phones, there were no computers, and yet the women's inner lives were very similar to the way they are now. And
yeah,
they felt a certain restlessness in their domesticity. They enjoyed it. As I did, I love being a wife and mother, but at the same time, I wanted something else and I didn't know what it was. And then I discovered writing.
Oh, it's so nice. I think that that restlessness and that feeling plagues a lot of people, right? People who are, whether you're at home or your career has been shifted by kids or, you know, having kids automatically just shifts something major in your life. And I mean, that sounded so silly to say, but the way you capture it is so just on the nose. I was hoping I could just read this one passage, if that's okay, from Knights. You wrote, "What men learn is that there are some women in this world who are never satisfied, who move through their homes with the restlessness of day workers. Even their blood seems restless, rising and falling so that they are alternately pale or flushed and suffer from dizzy spells and capricious moods. I am one of these women."
Indeed, I was.
You still are.
Still am.
And I looked like 20 times at the front to make sure that it said stories and not essays. I'm like, is this about her life or it's not about her life? Is Howard actually her husband or not her husband? Or just a character that you've been following for decades?
Well, I do feel very protective of my own privacy and my family's privacies. And also, I think it's more fun to invent people, but I have to use some experiences from my own life. So I call it truth wrapped in a lie. The most autobiographical story in the collection is the final story, The Great Escape, the only really brand new story. And I felt after my husband and I contracted COVID-19, and he died of it. And after I came home, we were in separate hospitals. It was a very traumatic experience. But after I came home, he wasn't there. I hadn't seen him. I hadn't really experienced his death in a way. We were separated before it happened. And when I came home, I was grieving, but it also didn't seem real. It seems so real in a way. And writing about it several months later, I must say, it made it real. And it also was a form of grieving, and it gave me an opportunity to deal with it and accept it and go on. And it made a really big difference. It was painful to write, but it was also cathartic.
I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Tough, but on the other hand, we were married for 68 years and we were both past the age of 90. And that is a great gift that not many people get.
It's true. Very true. But still, I was just, you know, yesterday, this weekend was my grandmother's 98th birthday. She passed away when she was 97. But just because she lived that long doesn't mean I miss her any less. Right.
No.
It's still from one moment to the next. I know you expect it logically, right, that someone you love is getting older and you should be prepared. But whether it's my dog or my grandmother or whatever, like even it doesn't make it any better just because you know.
No, you've known her longer, which makes it in a way harder. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you know, my husband and I were so used to each other and so companionable. I didn't think I was going to write any more fiction at that point. We had a really nice old age, I have to say. We had some illnesses and stuff that we could deal with. But coronavirus just blindsided us. It was just so shocking. And the day he went off to the hospital, I had to call 911 because he suddenly couldn't stand up and was running a very high fever. And as I say in the story, the EMTs kept yelling at me to get his phone, get his charger, get his pajamas. And I was racing around doing everything and then running after the gurney down the hall to the elevator. We live in a high rise in Manhattan. And I never said goodbye to him. I never said, I love you. I never said anything. We did talk to each other on the phone because a few days later I came down with it and was in a different hospital. And we did talk every night on the phone till almost the end. The final night I was told, and this really broke my heart, was that he was told on Friday night that I was coming home on Monday. And he died a few hours after he was told that. And he couldn't speak anymore, but he clapped. He applauded. Oh. And that was too much for me to even put into the story. I changed details, and I also assigned the events of the story to those fictional characters who are not us. They were not my husband and me, but they lived parallel lives. And they were sort of like friends who had moved away. And I always wondered what happened to them. And by writing about them was the way I found out. And I'm still going to write about her again now, I think. I hope.
I hope you do too. That was so moving. I'm so sorry you went through that. That scene in your story too, when she chases after him and yells down sort of the elevator or whatever, I love you. And Oh my gosh, so many people who didn't get to say the proper goodbyes. It's just terrible.
I know. But you know, I felt isolated, but I didn't feel alone because the whole world was going through this. I felt as if I were part of something very large. And though, you know, each person's loss is tragic to them, the whole world was going through a kind of mass tragedy with this terrible virus.
I'm not sure that made it any better, though. I mean, my husband's mother passed away from COVID. She was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and her mother passed away before her, which is how she got it. And so she was 87. They lived together. And then she had it, and then she went to the hospital, and my mother-in-law got it, and it was this whole thing. And they had her put on a hazmat suit in the hospital to say goodbye, and she had to stuff it with all this ice cubes because she already had a fever herself. And anyway.
So sorry. Just awful. And then the aftermath of it was that you couldn't have any of the rituals that you usually have. There was no funeral. Right. We didn't get together afterwards. I didn't see my children. They didn't see me. And not only that, all of my husband's things were still in the apartment, his clothing, his shoes were next to the bed, his toothbrush was in the holder. I mean, it was really, that made it less real in a way. And finally, more than a year later, when my grandsons were finally vaccinated, they came over and helped me both emotionally and physically, because my husband never threw out a belt or a pair of socks, obviously, and his closet was jammed with stuff. And the boys came over, the men, I should say, my young men grandsons, and they stuffed everything into trash bags and took it to a charitable organization. And it felt good to have them there to begin with. And my husband was a psychologist, but he moonlighted as a jazz musician sometimes in his youth. He played sax and clarinet. He played bar mitzvahs and weddings and stuff like that. And I had his sax in this big box under my computer desk, and I would rest my feet on it. But I was really happy to give it to my younger grandson, who's a musician. And my husband would have wanted him to have it. So that actually felt good.
Oh.
But that's not what the whole book is about.
No. I'm sorry. And I know.
Even that story. That story is really about a long marriage. And it has some funny aspects of what marriage is like as well. Because to me, there's always humor at the edge of the darkness.
That's a beautiful way to say that. You must be a writer. No, and I didn't mean to suggest, I know we started talking about this, but no, the stories cover so many different things. And the funniest part, I think, of the whole collection is when you're talking about Howard's first wife, and you're trying to figure out like the alimony and all that. And you said it would be cheaper if you just adopted her.
I had so much fun writing that story.
Oh my gosh, that cracked me up.
That was Elizabeth Strout's favorite story in the collection, she said. She wrote that wonderful forward to the collection.
She did. That was also amazing. So that story was called Overtime, about how Howard's first wife wouldn't let him go. And you said her hold on him wasn't even sexual. I could have dealt with that. It would have been an all-out war, and of course I would have won. There was something final about me and steadying. I wondered why he was attracted to her in the first place. Yeah, and then she said, yeah, we gave Renee plenty of money, although she denied all legal rights to alimony. They were only married 7 months, and she decided she didn't deserve alimony after such a short relationship, that you can't even collect unemployment insurance unless you've been on the job for a while. But we were always giving her money anyway. 10 here, 5 there. Ostensibly, they were loans, but Renee was hard-pressed to repay them. I suggested to Howard that we adopt her, that it would be cheaper, tax-wise and all, but Howard seemed to really consider the idea, getting that contemplative look in his eye, chewing his dinner in a slow, even rhythm. I imagined Renee living with us, another bed in the converted dinette where the children sleep.
It was fun to think of that. I don't even know where it came from, actually.
Oh my gosh, too funny. So these characters that have sort of gone through, oh, and I also love this in Trophies. When you wrote Howard's father died, moving Howard up one generation and canceling forever his coming attractions of life. That was such a nice way to say that, right? Because when you lose somebody, you're also losing all those things that you had sort of planned on happening. So I love how it's sort of deleting the coming attractions, if you will, as a concept. What is it like to follow a character for so long, because I get very invested in characters from fiction as well. Like, I feel like they're real people and I want them to meet, like, characters from different books, I'm sure would be friends. I want to have like a universe where that happens.
That's a brilliant idea for a book, by the way.
I know, that's what I really want to do. I actually asked two authors who I was just like, your characters have to meet, because I always am connecting people in real life. But I was like, your two characters have to meet. Why don't you guys get together and write a story where those two characters, you know, interact? Because, but anyway, one of them was too busy, and maybe I'll come back to it. But then I'm wondering, should it be the original authors who have to co-write this book? Or could there be a book with lots of characters drawn from all the different books? I don't know.
It's a terrific idea for a novel. And actually, E.L. Doctorow, when he wrote Ragtime, he had real people meet in the book, like J.P. Morgan and Houdini and people like that. And his editor asked him if they had actually ever met. And he said, now they have. So that's the power of fiction, I think.
It's so true. I mean, who's to say, I mean, this sounds ridiculous. Once you create these characters, like, don't they have some sort of space in the world in some way, shape, or form? They become so real. I mean, I know they're not ghosts, or I don't know what to call them, but I don't know. There's just something with staying power. And then your characters, right? This man Howard's are bopping around through his life. And as he follows your path, right? Where does Howard go? I don't know.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. A
wonderful mystery. And they do seem real to me while I'm writing them. And after I'm finished with a book, with a novel, or even a short story, I feel bereft. I feel I miss the characters. They're good company. And I always said that writing is a solitary occupation, but it's not a lonely one, because you have all these characters living inside your head so long, they should be paying rent at this point.
Maybe rent-controlled rates or something.
Right. Definitely.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLaughlin. Jay McLaughlin is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLaughlin and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLaughlin stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLaughlin's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLaughlin's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern, and the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLaughlin, and so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLaughlin is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLaughlin. Thanks so much. Hey, grownups. The Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week.
Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. So sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. I actually interviewed your daughter, Meg, like maybe 3 years ago, I feel like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. What is it like having writing so running in the family at this point? What is that relationship? How has that affected your relationship?
Well, it's even made it better. It's terrific to begin with because she's so much fun and we're really friends as well as mother and daughter. But we have this other thing in common, language. Stories. We share work with one another. We share first drafts. And Meg started writing very early. I was a late bloomer and she was a very early bloomer. And when she was a child, she was writing these terrific little stories. And she would show them to me and I would say they were terrific, which they were. And after a while, she became angry. And she said, "You just love everything I do." And realized that she wanted to be treated with more respect. She wanted to be a peer. So I was more critical. And then, of course, she burst into tears. So I had to find some happy medium, some balance between honesty and charity, which actually worked. And I carried over into workshops when I was teaching, because you had to be honest with the student whose work was up for criticism. Otherwise, you weren't constructive. But you also had to be aware of the person behind the story, of somebody sitting there with a fast beating heart, hoping you won't say something disastrous, which is what happened to me, actually, a bad experience. In my mid-30s, when I began to write short stories, I took a writing workshop with Anatole Bruyard at the New School. It was a beginner's workshop. And we all had to submit stories. And the very first night, the classroom was packed. There must have been 50 people there. And he called on me first to come to the front of the room and read my story aloud. First of all, I had stage fright and I felt very embarrassed. And he also told me to spit out my gum, which was even more humiliating. And I got to the front of the room. I read the story very quickly without any affect and collapsed into a chair. And Anatole asked if anybody would like to comment on it. And a man raised his hand and said, "That was the most boring thing I ever heard." Well, I wanted to cry as much as Meg did as a child. But Anatole passed me a note which said, "The story is fine. See me later." And then he said to my critic, "You have every right to dislike the story and to find it boring, but you're obligated to tell the writer why you think it's boring and how she might make it better." Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I understood about revision and also about teaching. And after class, I spoke to him and he moved me into an advanced class where I read the same story aloud again, and they didn't like it either. But they said they gave me constructive criticism, which was much easier to take. And I felt I was launched as a writer then.
Wow, what a great story. And see, whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the critic, like whatever happened to the critic?
Oh, everybody asked that. I have no idea. I don't remember his name. I do remember his face. He looked quite smug.
Yeah. Well, probably nothing good happened to that guy, you know. There's karma in the world, after all.
Yeah.
Wow. What types of books do you read? Do you love to read? I'm assuming. I shouldn't assume, but do you love to read? And if so, what do you like to read?
I like to read fiction, of course, and I like to read essays, and I love to read biographies. I'm interested in people's real lives and their imagined lives. Right now, I have O. William on my bedside table.
Yep.
And I've also had to be doing some reading for essays that I was assigned to write for. I did one for the Wall Street Journal, and I'm doing one. I just did one for the Guardian in London, in Manchester, rather. And I had to choose books to talk about. And so I was rereading those books, Stanley Elkin's wonderful The Living End. One of my favorite writers, a British writer, Jane Gardam, her book, God on the Rocks, which is a terrific book. And I'm rereading Sleepless Nights by Elizabeth Hardwick. So my shelves are bulging, and I just have to reach my hand out, and I have company for the night.
Part of why I even started this whole podcast and all of this was after I got divorced, I had every other weekend, it was so quiet, right? My kids weren't here. I have four kids of my own, and it was just so sort of sad and quiet. And this therapist I went to said, you know, Zivi, you love to read so much. You know, with a good book, you'll never be lonely. And so that's like, that's it. I just like read all the time. I'm not lonely. I'm remarried. Everything's fine. But yeah.
And that's where the title of your whole program came from.
Yes, pretty much.
I would think that moms don't have time to write either. And when I began to write, I was doing it at the kitchen table. No one was really taking me seriously. First of all, I hadn't published anything yet. And my husband and I, we were a two typewriter family. We had two standard typewriters. He was at one end of the kitchen table typing up. He, as I said, he was the psychologist. He was typing up his patients' reports. And I was at the other end typing my stories. The kids were running around. The dog was barking. And my children actually came home for lunch from school. Their school was a block away. So I only had those couple of hours in the morning to be totally alone and a couple of hours in the afternoon. And no one really took it seriously. My parents would call up and they would talk to me in stereo on two phones. And my mother might say, you know, what are you doing today? And I would say, I'm writing a short story. And she would say, did the sheets arrive from Macy's? As if I hadn't said it. But then when I sold the first story of the Saturday Evening Post for enough money to put a down payment on my first car, and which really made a very big difference in terms of my independence, because we lived in the suburbs and I had no car. So I had to walk my children everywhere and wait till my husband came home to go to the supermarket to get groceries and stuff. So this was a miracle. And it was the Saturday Evening Post. And when I told my father, he said, wow, I read that at the dentist. It gave it such authority. And it did make a difference. I felt, okay, now I'm really a writer and I'm going to write a story a week or a month. And a friend of my husband said, well, you'll have a fleet of ramblers, which is what I bought. Unfortunately, I didn't publish a story for 3 years. And then it was to a very small, prestigious literary magazine, but I only got like $100 or something like that, enough to put some gas in that. And I realized I wasn't in this for the money, which was just as well.
Wow. Just out of curiosity, where is your family from originally?
You mean my parents?
Yeah.
My mother was born in the United States. My father was born in what was Russia, Bessarabia, Romania, Moldavia. I mean, it kept changing. The borders just kept changing. And it was not a literary household, but there was a real oral tradition. First of all, we were a three-generation household. My grandmother, an aunt, lived with us. Aunts and uncles were in the neighborhood. Everybody came over on Saturday. And I remember lying under the kitchen table and just listening among the shoes, just listening to these great stories. And this was during the Great Depression and during World War II. And yet there was so much laughter. My family really had a collective great sense of humor. And that was so uplifting during that period. Because I remember my father was out of work. Things were really tough. And yet there was a feeling of optimism and joy.
Wow.
Which I think eventually permeated my own stories.
That's wonderful. That's so beautiful. I love that image of you underneath the table. Oh my gosh. That's just, I feel like it should be a little illustration or something somewhere.
Yeah. And they spoke in English, broken English, Yiddish, and Pig Latin. And I learned every language so that I could understand what they were talking about. If they didn't want me to know something, I desperately wanted to know it. And it's that curiosity that I think most writers have. What happens next? Mm-hmm. What are other people thinking?
Yep.
How are their inner lives? And I happen to believe that everyone has an interesting inner life.
Yep.
And a psychiatrist friend of mine said, no, they don't. And she heard too many boring stories, but I still believe it. And going to work when I was young and going to work on the subway, I remember sitting opposite a whole bunch of other people and making up stories about their lives. It was a way of getting through the boring subway ride too. But it was interesting. I just feel that you have to consider the other with sympathy, empathy, and curiosity.
I completely agree. I love that. All right. What advice would you give to aspiring authors, aspiring writers?
Keep doing it, no matter what. Even if your mother asks you if you got the sheets from Macy's, just keep writing. Ignore that. And also, read your work aloud. If you read your own work aloud, not for an audience, but for yourself, you can hear the clunkers. You can hear if there's any musicality to it. And also read a lot of other people. It's like eating language, and you then have it within you. To me, reading improves my vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, I'm just filled with language. And when my characters come to tell me their stories, and I feel they do, I don't get stories. I get characters, and then my characters tell me their stories. And it usually starts with a sentence. And so I would tell writers to revise, to read, and just not to give up. You're writing first for yourself. Publication is very pleasing and also harrowing, because you have to deal with reviews and rejections. Rejections first and then reviews and then maybe bad sales. I remember, you know, my agent once saying most writers on their pub date say, when is something going to happen? And he hates to tell them, never. I feel very lucky, though. I've had a really good writing life and I've had a good personal life as well. So I feel fortunate. This is a very strange time of life. I'm 91. I'll be 92 in January if I make it. And I'm alone and I'm independent and I want to maintain that independence, but I'm worried about it. And this is the next story I want to write about this character, Paulette, who was widowed in that final story. And she might worry about the same thing. And I wonder how she would deal with it, how her children would behave, what they would do. And I feel I'm going to write that story.
I can't wait to read that story. I can't wait. Hilma, this has been so nice. I like love you. This is like I just feel such affection, even though I just met you. So anyway, thank you for everything. And I'm just a huge fan.
Sibby, thank you for that and for doing this for other writers and readers and moms. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.